All right, team, let me tell you about NewZest, clean, plant-based nutrition products to meet the demands of modern life. And I'm super excited to announce that they are a sponsor of Micropedia. With over a decade of experience and a presence in more than 20 countries worldwide, NewZest has emerged as a leader in providing innovative solutions for those seeking healthier and more sustainable choices. In a world where people are looking for clean labels, easily digestible ingredients, and allergen-free options, NewZest delivers and totally has you covered. Clean Lean Protein is a plant-based protein powder and contains all 9 essential amino acids. It encourages recovery, vitality, muscle repair, and growth, and helps you hit your protein requirements, which you know I am all about. One of my favorite products is their Good Green Vitality. It's the gold standard in multi-nutrients. It's designed to make complex nutrition simple. The Super Blend is carefully formulated to address all aspects of health, 75 ingredients working together to support everything from digestion, immunity, and healthy aging, to stress, energy, and cognition in one daily serve. Grab yours today, guys, with a sweet 20% discount for being a listener of the show with the code Micropedia over at their website, and we will pop a link in the show notes for you to be able to do that. All right, now back to the show. Hey, everyone, it's Mickey here. You're listening to Micropedia, and this week on the podcast, I welcome back Dr. Cliff Harvey and Darren Ellis. As always, guys, we have such a fun conversation. Cliff and Darren and I discuss strength training, fitness, nutrition, health, and just things that are sparking their interests right now. You know, what I love most about our conversations is not only is there a practical element, so you will learn new things that you will be able to practically apply, I also find talking to people with the types of perspectives that both Cliff and Darren have opens me up to thinking about things in a different way. You know, they've got just some great insights into how the world works from their perspective. And any time that we, I guess, expose ourselves to different ways of thinking, you can just grow from that. And this is what I love about having super smart friends like Cliff and Darren. Now, both of these guys have been on the podcast before. Numerous times, actually. Cliff Harvey is New Zealand's expert on the effects of a ketogenic diet in a healthy population, but he is so much more than that. He has been helping people to live healthier, happier lives and to perform better since starting in clinical practice back in the late 1990s. Over this time, he has been privileged to work with many Olympic, professional, Commonwealth and other high-performing athletes, along with just, you know, general people. And he has also helped many people overcome the effects of chronic and debilitating health conditions. Along the way, he has founded or co-founded many successful businesses in the health, fitness, and wellness space, including the Holistic Performance Institute, New Zealand's leading certification and diploma for health, nutrition, health coaching, and performance that has many of the world's experts teaching on the course, so students are learning from the best. Cliff has over 20 years' experience as a strength and nutrition coach, and in addition to his PhD research, he is a registered clinical nutritionist, a qualified naturopathic professional, and he holds a diploma in fitness. So you can find Cliff over at cliffharvey.com or head to the Holistic Performance Institute for more information on their courses. And Darren is another New Zealand guru. He has a master's degree in exercise physiology and obviously a phys ed background. He was the first person to bring CrossFit to New Zealand shores, and he has an aim to share what he's learned with as many people as possible, teaching them that there are no shortcuts with exercise, but that it can be achievable and even fun with good coaching and a supportive peer group. He is a regular contributor to a variety of popular print and web-based health and fitness magazines, public speaker and consultant to sporting organizations, businesses, universities, and television. And he is also our lead strength expert in Mondays Matter. What Darren doesn't know about fitness probably isn't worth knowing. So you can find Darren at www.darrenellis.coach, and obviously we'll put links to Darren and Cliff in the show notes so you can reach out to them directly. Before we crack on into the show though, I would just like to remind you that the best way to support this podcast is to hit the subscribe button on your favorite podcast listening platform. And why not just be that most awesome person and leave a 5-star review? Because that increases the show's visibility out there and amongst the literally thousands of other podcasts. Thanks, team. Appreciate you. For now, though, please enjoy the conversation that I have with Dr. Cliff Harvey and Darren Ellis. Nice one. Anyway, how's our week gone, team?
Sick kids. So, yeah. Work from home, but then again, it's weird because I'm also extremely grateful that we can manage it, because I'm here anyway. It just means I get less work done. But as opposed to I need to take a sick day,
yeah,
arrange to stay home from work or something like that, or do the sneaky dose them up with Pam. I'll send them off and cross fingers. Don't get a phone call an hour later.
Yeah, nice one. So guys, tell me what's been up this morning. Do you guys have a morning routine? Do either of you?
Coffee. I'm definitely a creature of habit. I roll out of bed when I hear Dexter calling out. Go and get him set up for some breakfast, have 2 glasses of water, a shake with protein, greens, and fish oil, then hit the coffee, and then train every bloody day.
Nice.
More or less.
Yes. Yeah. Do you know, if I don't train in the morning, my brain doesn't fire the same way. And I was thinking about this morning because I have a podcast with Anna Lemke? She wrote Dopamine Nation.
I think it's
Lemsip.
Oh, sorry. No, that's Pseudoephedrine Nation.
Yes. There you go.
Soon to be returning to our shores.
Yeah. What a weird sort of flagship policy.
What policy is this?
So the ACT Party has pushed really hard as one of their first policy initiatives to get pseudoephedrine back on shelves, which is fine. I mean, who cares? It's a good decongestant, right? So it works for people, but it seems like a strange thing. We've got so many challenges to really pin a lot of time and effort on that. But hey, I guess it's, it is what it is.
Maybe that's one of the things that they can do quite quickly, because they do have that 100 days in policy. We want to do these, or 100 days in government, we want to do these 100 things, right? So maybe that was like, well, that seems like an easy win quickly.
Yeah, and it might have been one of those ones that it was sort of not contentious at all. So it could just be, you know, passed pretty easily. But yeah, we derailed your Dopamine Nation.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that was my fault. Mickey, I'm not exercising at all in the mornings, and I'm feeling it because I'm the same as you guys. I love that routine, and we're just currently going through, some interesting sleep-wake things where it's sort of, I think I have a moment, and then Billy jumps out of the bedroom, and she's wide awake, and my wife's just got into surfing, and she's mad for it, and so I'm definitely trying to give her, like, first crack if the conditions are right.
Oh, that's cool.
So I go out into the lounge and I'll just do like 5 minutes of mobility or something and get my little dose there. It's not, we'll work our way back to it.
Yeah.
Because I'm the same as you guys.
Because people often say, oh, is it the endorphins? You know, is it the endorphins that that gets you fired up in the morning? And I just wonder whether it's more dopamine actually. What is it?
Like, it's the arrogance for me. It's pure, like, I got more done before you even got out of bed. that's what helps me get through the day, just that scorn, this disdain for the rest of the human race.
Yeah, that's sounds a bit like you, Darren. That sounds like your personality type.
Well, I mean, you could probably test it out. You could get up one morning, train, get up the next morning, do a couple of lines of coke, you know, see whether it's the whole dopamine thing. No, I think with anything, it's very easy to over-compartmentalize it, I guess, or, you know, to really get down into one pathway or one chemical. But with exercise, you know, it's so many things. Sure, there's going to be biochemical responses. There's going to be some endorphins. You know, are they really that appreciable from weight training? I'm not sure. or is that more, you know, from that long sustained sort of cardio? But of course, there's going to be just straight sort of stimulant responses in terms of catecholamines. There's going to be dopamine, but you're also breathing, you're standing up that little bit straighter, you know, your posture, you've probably got a bit of that sort of synovial fluid, you know, activation, and you're sliding the fascia around and doing all those things. I mean, plus there's the psychosocial stuff where you're doing something that you know is good for you and in line with what your, you know, ethos and values are. So there's so much wrapped up with it. I think the key thing is you do it in the morning, you just feel better because you kind of somewhere deep down know it's got to be done. So you've done it.
Mm.
And ticking things off is such a massive, I mean, that probably does play into the dopamine thing too, right? Like that's why having a short to-do list, even if you've got another long one, is such a good strategy, because if you're ticking off those key things on any given day, you feel so accomplished, and that's a massive thing.
Well, I have to say, with to-do lists, I even put things on there that I've already done, so I can immediately tick it off. Like, oh yeah, put that on my to-do list. Oh yeah, did that already.
That's
and like you do. Well, you feel good.
Silly. That's a really good idea.
Yeah. Apps have got the streak. It's like, you know, such a common thing to add is, you know, what's your daily streak?
Yeah.
Yes.
Gamifying that to-do list for exercise. And I definitely think, of course, morning exercise, you have the least possible resistance, less obstacles to getting it done. You just get out of bed and you do it. You've got a better chance of maintaining that streak or starting that streak or however you want to look at it when it's in the morning.
I almost never train if it's not in the morning now. If I miss my training in the morning, I can bet 9 times out of 10 I'm not going to get it done later.
You know what? I'm pretty much exactly the same, Cliff. And also what I notice is that even though I have this, so I have a feeling of, like, to your point of the fact that you get it done and you sort of know you need to because it's sort of good for you and it fits your values or whatever, like there is a relief when it's done. Like I was finishing up in the pool this morning and I'm like, cool, got that done. And if I miss a session in the morning or I have a scheduled rest day, which seldom happens, like the last rest day I had was actually Sunday because I just ran that 50K on Saturday. So I'm like, I suppose I have to rest today, don't I? Even though not everyone did. I had one girl I know, she's an like epic runner. She went out for a 5K run. And I'm like, oh. She went out for a run. But you know, that was a scheduled rest day. But if I sort of, by the time I get to mid-morning, the disappointment of missing a session has left, actually. So I know that sometimes it's a bit of, when you know you need to rest, even though you don't really want to, this is by you, I mean me, I know that time will pass and actually I'll forget that I didn't exercise this morning. And that actually is just a bit of a relief from my obsessive personality mindset around training, really. Because if I was addicted to anything, it would 100% be to the feeling of having exercised. That's what I think I'm addicted to.
It's interesting, the topic of morning routines, because like I say, I'm a creature of habit and I do generally do the same thing day in, day out. But over a longer period of time, that can still change, you know, especially when it comes to things like training. Because at the moment, I have 2 full rest days a week. That's just because it just doesn't work on those days to train mostly. But it works out with other things I'm doing because I have a much harder training session the following day just by nature of how things are planned at the moment. And so I'm doing longer, like quite long comparative to the sort of time I've got available, because obviously with kids and work and all that kind of stuff, there's not a lot of time, but relatively long training sessions, pretty high intensity, you know, really trying to push hard in those sessions, but fewer of them. Whereas at other times I might be doing, you know, just a 15 or 30 minute session every single day, or maybe, you know, a 15 minute session twice a day. And so it's the only reason I bring that up is I've been talking to quite a few students about this. The idea of experimenting and having fun and allowing things to shift with your life, I think, is really important, because so many people are trying to find the perfect training plan, the perfect diet plan, the perfect supplement that's going to solve their problems. But something might work for a while. It doesn't mean that it will or has to work for the long term. You know, and I was talking about that with a student the other day. I said, well, look, the way I'm eating at the moment is quite different to how I was eating probably 12 months ago. And that's just because it feels right to do it this way at the moment. So, you know, it's pretty different, but it's working. And we shouldn't get married, I don't think, to any particular diet or training strategy, I don't think, because that might become incompatible with what we're trying to do at some point.
I wonder whether we need to, in fact, get married to the way we feel, you know, like what's going to get you to that outcome that you desire, and these sort of methods and stuff will change. I'm going to come back to your diet changes in a minute, Cliff, because you and I often talk about what Cliff's doing in terms of supplements and diet. But I don't know, Darren, that I've ever asked you about your diet necessarily, like in a way of, you know, what are you like, how much has your diet sort of shifted over the last few years? Because you're very much a CrossFit paleo-esque person back in the day.
Well, it's funny timing, because I think I just threw it in a story. It just came up through some Q&A stuff I was doing on there, that I've all but quit bacon. And it used to be such a, like, almost a point of pride in those early CrossFit days. Like someone had given us permission to eat bacon because it was paleo. And hey, it's just protein and fat, so what's wrong with it?
And I
was on that bandwagon hard. And it's not difficult, because bacon is delicious. But for whatever reason, my taste for it has just sort of mellowed over the years, maybe through the sheer tonnage I've consumed. a bit like tuna in my student years, you know. And I think I mentioned that on the last potty I was on with you, Zoom call with you, that I tried it again, but felt like the first time in 20 years, and it wasn't too bad. But I don't know for sure that canned tuna is making it back into the rotation. bacon, we've had the last two packets of bacon in the fridge have gone off. Where they've been opened for a meal and then still not really touched again, and then it starts to get this real weird aroma.
It goes sort of green.
Aged. I guess I've gone through that sort of gamut of sort of getting exposed from a primal sort of Marxism perspective, and then getting quite strict with it. I can remember, even I was relaying this to someone, being at a restaurant where the service was really slow and the meals hadn't turned up, but there was a basket of bread sitting on there, and we were all these hardcore CrossFitters, and we were just staring at this bread. No one was going to touch it because bread was the devil, and we didn't, and we didn't get served. Like, it was like 10 p.m. or something ridiculous that dinner finally came out. But that's where we're at, and now, eating the crust off my daughter's bread pretty much daily.
Yeah.
And, it's a whole different approach. So I'm still just probably real food. I would say I'm still on the lower carb end of the spectrum. This seems to feel right for me. And I, as far as nutrient timing, most of my carbs would end up sort of post-workout. But really, yeah, I guess eat meat and veggies is my thing. But it does, like Cliff mentioned, it seems like that'll take different, that'll appear in a different way on a slower track.
Cliff, what about you? What are you doing differently now than what you were, say, 12 months ago, when we might have last had this conversation, actually?
It's funny that Daz says that about bacon, because I had a very similar thought about full fat milk, because like it came back strong, right? And I don't think there's anything wrong with full fat milk, obviously. You know, all the research tells us that full fat dairy is no risk to mortality. It's basically the same as any other type of dairy, whatever. So I think it became, though, it almost became a badge of honor for people who were maybe in, not paleo, because that's obviously dairy, but maybe in the more primal, low carb sort of space, that you have to have full fat dairy. But I don't think that's not congruent with the research or like what we necessarily can and should be doing personally, because it just means that there's no problem with full fat dairy. So anyway, I bring that up because I recently have sort of thought, well, why am I having full fat dairy if I can have like a low fat or trim milk that has a lot more protein in it? Because one of the things I typically find if I'm tracking, because I do track, you know, once every 6 to 12 months or something, just to check in and see where I'm at, is that sometimes I am a little bit under protein, especially if I'm stressed, working hard, whatever. And it's the difference between, you know, maybe having a glass of milk with a Clif Bar or something and getting, what would it be, maybe 21 grams of protein versus over 30 grams of protein. It adds up, right? It's quite a lot. Because with the the ultra filtered milks, they're quite high in protein. Sometimes it can be almost double what you get from full fat milk. So that's one change I've made is if I feel like I'm, you know, needing something, I don't really want to eat a full meal, a protein bar and a big glass of milk, which could have been a fallback in the past, has got that much more protein in it. So it's just kind of an interesting thing where it's you're losing some of the dogma that's associated with diet styles just to make things a bit more functional. But how I'm eating now is I realized that I was falling into a trap of probably not eating that much in the morning again. And that's not a problem, except that I tend to undereat. And so when I get up in the morning, like I say, I have a big protein shake with greens and fish oil in it. After training, I have a really big protein shake. So I have usually about a gram of protein per kilo body weight. So for me, that's 90 grams of protein with, you know, mango and creatine and peanut butter and all sorts of stuff thrown in there. But then I typically don't really eat much during the day. And this is quite similar to how I used to eat maybe 10 or 15 years ago. And it's mainly just because I'm so busy at the moment, I just don't feel like eating and I don't feel like sitting down and forcing myself to have a big lunch. So if I have anything at all, I'll typically just grab a whole bunch of crisp vegetables or fruit. So it might be, you know, celery and capsicums and, you know, if I've got an apple there or whatever, and just cut all that up and just eat it because it feels good in summer to be eating that crunchy, fresh kind of stuff. And I find that gets me through the day completely fine, probably because I've had that massive bolus of protein in the morning too. And then I just have, you know, a sort of protein veggie-based dinner. And pretty much after every dinner, I have chocolate and milk. And that's kind of like my diet, right? It's funny though, too, because I think I'm eating more vegetables because if I do have anything during the day, I have a big serve of vegetables. And that frees me up a little bit at night because I'm not really that big a fan of having vegetables with dinner. I like having meat, pretty much just meat, maybe some carbs, you know. And most of my carbs are in the evening because through the day, it's not a lot of carbohydrate. Even if I am having a little bit of fruit or quite a lot of vegetables, obviously, it's still bugger all carbs. So it kind of is that carb backloading style, not for any purpose and not because carb backloading is in any way magical. It's not. It's just what works. And I like having the carbs at night because it feels more comforting. I think it helps to drive down that stress response. And it's just one of those things, you know, you eat a whole bunch of carbs with dinner and afterwards you feel sleepy and that's great.
So a couple of things there. One is I really interesting to your point, Cliff, about full fat dairy. And, you know, when we did all go through that primal sort of phase and full fat came back on the menu, a lot of, like me included, sort of read that as, oh, fat-free is just terrible. Like, we shouldn't be doing that. Not for the reason why a lot of people would say, you know, so high in sugar. Which is, none of the low-fat dairy that I ever chose was ever high in sugar. But it was almost like this absolute backlash. Like, anything fat-free had to be unnatural and, you know, not ideal for you. And I would, however, once I sort of like shifted my thing and actually thought more about it, well, actually, that's not true. You know, have the dairy that you prefer became sort of my sort of thing. Like, if you prefer low fat, absolutely do that. I'd get a lot of backlash, actually, like particularly when I put up something like the D. Winkle carton of yogurt, like that's the one that we get when it's on special. Otherwise, it's Gopala. And people would go, oh, it's terrible. It's fat-free yogurt. Like, just eat the full fat. And it's like, well, actually, for some people, Cliff mentioned the difference in protein that you're not going to find with the yogurt per se, but just, you know, that's one reason why someone might choose a lower fat, but also just calories. You know, there are people who are trying to improve their body composition. We need to create a calorie deficit. And if it's no sacrifice to you, do the low fat dairy rather than sort of spend your calories on the full fat version, which could be double what you would otherwise take in. Like, low fat to me just sort of makes sense to that regard. And
I've been similar, and that's thanks to you, Mickey.
Oh,
cottage cheese is found. It's like the tuna. It's found its way back from its student days back into my life, and it's partly like a caloric approach, and then partly, like you were saying, Cliff, the protein load. This struggle in the morning, and eggs seem like they're this massive protein dose, right? And you chuck five in a bowl and you're still looking at 30, 35 grams.
Yeah.
Which isn't bad, but you know, if you are eating three meals or even two meals, you'd need to work a little harder. And so whether it's topping it up with some egg whites or some cottage cheese or some lower fat cheese so that, yeah, again, you can get that size. I'm someone who likes to eat bigger. I know you've talked about that too, Mickey.
Yeah, nice.
Getting your protein macros ticked without the expense of potentially calories you don't need is real helpful. So yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, and what I tend to do, I agree with you, obviously, Darren. I'm pleased that you've taken on board some of my, you know, little nuggets of wisdom. The way that what I tend to do with my eating changes across the week, because I know is one of the reasons why, is because when Baz comes home in the week or in the weekends, we generally like a little snack plate before dinner. And so on those, those snack plate has like the, you know, the Snicks, pork rindy type things. We love them, and cheese and prosciutto and things like that, which will end up being like several more sort of 100 calories that you're taking in before dinner. And one, I don't like to eat when I'm not hungry. So, and I also know that I like to enjoy the snack plate and then enjoy dinner. So I find that I do what you describe, Cliff, and eat a bit lighter during the day. So by the time it does get to that sort of 5 o'clock time, I'm like ready to have a snack plate and then ready to have dinner and not feel overfull and just feel like I've, you know, like you sort of, you pick and choose what you want to spend your calories on, basically.
That's exactly. That's such a good point, Mickey. And it really annoys me when people say, you know, don't try and bank your calories and stuff like that, because I understand where they're coming from, because for some people that can be problematic behavior and it can lead to additional like disordered eating, right? But if you're not going to fall into that sort of state, and you know, today I probably won't eat as much as I otherwise would. I'm not going to force myself to not eat, but I'm not going to sort of worry about eating too much, because I know that we typically have burgers on a Friday night, right? So I know there's a lot coming in. I don't think there's any issue with that, in the same way that I'll probably not feel like eating tomorrow morning because we've had a massive feed, right? So it's not so much about forcing oneself to not do something to try and bank the calories. It's more sort of listening to the body to some degree and maybe having some pragmatism around that. And if it's not, like I say, if it's not going to lead to any problematic behavior, it's a good strategy to help keep your energy intake in balance. And I don't think there's any problem with that whatsoever. It's almost like the opposite is if we're listening to some of these influencers who are saying, no, you've got to stay on track, like eat that meal. So, well, I'm going to have those treats on Friday night anyway. So by eating that meal tomorrow, I then have to probably be that much more moderate through the other meals to try and have it all balance out, you know. And so it just becomes a little bit more work.
100%. And what you've described there, Cliff, sounds to me like a bit of cognitive restraint going on Friday, but you've got a bit of auto-regulation going on Saturday, because you're just, you know, that's sort of that pragmatic versus listening to your body, right? It's a mix of both of those things, because auto-regulation can, and when you're in tune, you can much more rely on your hunger cues, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And it's similar to, you see a lot thrown around about the association between low-carb diets and eating disorders. And I think what's seldom taken into account by most people positing those messages is reverse causation. Because someone who doesn't have a tendency towards an eating disorder is not going to develop an eating disorder based on, or is unlikely to develop an eating disorder based on what type of diet or strategy they're following. It's more likely in most cases that people with latent eating disorders or disordered eating patterns are going to gravitate towards more restrictive diets. And so I think we need to be quite pragmatic about the types of rules that we put in place. You know, it's like the people who say, don't have a cheat meal. It's like, well, why are you saying that? Are you saying that the cheat meal is bad, or are you saying that the vernacular is bad? In other words, cheat, you know. And I think for a lot of people, maybe the idea of having a cheat isn't that positive for their mind state. But for some it is. And I think I've told you the story before about a student of mine who came from like a coding gaming sort of background. And she said, I love the word cheat because in my world, that means something you do to get a better result. it's like a hack to get, you know, a better result at the end of the system. And so for her, it was a really positive word. For a lot of people, it would be negative. So it's just a really good reminder that even what works well for most people most of the time, it's not going to work well for that individual or that group of individuals who have a different mind state.
That's such a good point. Because of course, I would never say cheat meal for all the reasons why we'd expect that I wouldn't, you know. Like, also though, I don't know that you've told me that story before, Cliff. If you have, I didn't listen to it. because I would never have thought about that from like using that term as in a sort of positive sense. It just super interesting.
What was the other one people used to say? Don't use the word treat because you're not a dog. And I'm like, oh, geez, what are we supposed to say then? You know, we're losing all these words. And I often do think of food as a treat. Like, you know, the end of a hard week at work.
Totally.
Just, I'm going to have a treat because I deserve it. I feel like it. It's going to help to, you know, feed my soul. I don't really care what I'm eating as long as it tastes good.
See, that's a really good point, actually, because I often think, you know, people say you shouldn't look at earning your food, right? Or earning, you know, what you do next. But like when we go out on like a day mission or even a long run, you better believe I'm thinking, awesome, I'm earning my start tonight, or, you know, and I don't think that's necessarily why does that have to be a negative thing? Like, I think you shouldn't treat food as a reward, but sometimes actually there may be situations, like in my head, I'm like, well, sort of, it is kind of a reward in this sense. Like, I'm going out to the pub, I'm having some hot chips, I'm having a beer because I just did this awesome effort. It's not that it was a grueling effort and I hated every step of the way, because that's not how I feel about it. I actually love doing it, but equally I love it because it then affords me my reward at the end. Mm. Like, is that a negative thing?
And if we go back far enough, it absolutely was a reward for the hard work that you did to get that meal created in the first place. And
yes.
I can speak to it through some of my younger day third world missions. Through Africa and places like that, buying a pig off a village, then having to, and I still can remember once, it was a bit of a loose unit pig, and we ended up feeding it marijuana in a banana and a sleeping pill that one of the other fellow travelers had to quiet it down so that we could hit it with an axe then stick it with the knife. And then we had to sit on it, you know, and it's chasing us around, and then build the fire and then create this, like, you know, jerry-rigged spit out of a bit of metal we found, and then turn it by hand for 10 hours in shifts.
Oh my goodness.
And then find, you know, that was not to mention we had to butcher this pig first, hoisting it up, you know, so a full day mission. And that pig at the end was manna from heaven. It was the most delicious thing I have ever eaten. Because we earned that treat. Boy, gosh, did we.
That's such a good point, Des, because I think people have lost that, but it's obviously so true, you know, biochemically and physiologically, that a lot of the, you know, the chemicals we're releasing in response to food are reward chemicals, right? So it literally is a reward for what you've done.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know if they've done studies to around taste. We must be, though, one of the few species that are really intricately involved in the taste of food. But, you know, they say dogs don't taste anything, pretty much. It's sort of like black and white, like it's safe or not. They just pretty much will hoover down anything. But I'm not too sure how much research is behind it. But certainly, if it's not the taste, there's the social aspect, which comes back to what I was saying as well, is that treat was enjoyed with everyone who had been helping out. You know, we shared the fruits of our labor. And so then we had that social treat of all of us sitting down there knackered, so satisfied with what we'd done, what we'd achieved, what was now laid out before us, and we got to enjoy it all together. And that's tough to try to deny yourself or reduce or take away because of, you know, a goal around body composition or performance or something like that. And so it's all on the spectrum, isn't it? Like what your idea of a treat is, what's a cheat. If you're white knuckling through a starvation day in order to have a treat, that's probably too far on the spectrum for both, like in terms of how you've moderated, you've gone too far, and also maybe how much you value a treat meal it's perhaps too high the other direction, and now you're at both extremes.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's that food as fuel mentality that a lot of people have. You know, food is not enjoyment, food is fuel. And I always just think, wow, what a limited way to live your life. If you want to do that, that's cool. And I'm not judging anybody, but to sort of have that as a blanket for everybody, I think is just so limiting. Because if we start to think about everything in that way, you know, training is not enjoyable. It's just a way to build your strength, you know, and build your resilience over time. And food is not enjoyable. It's just fuel. You know, we're starting to limit our human experience so much. What are we at that point? We're just automaton, right? And we can't.
Mm. Who's the guy who's trying to remove? You'd possibly know him. He talks about removing the, like, eating in a way that removes all pleasure, going for more of those bland approaches. It's not Stefan. No, I've lost now. But yeah, his approach was one of basically making food blander. To remove that sort of hedonistic approach.
Oh, are you talking about the satiety peeps, like Hava? Like don't possibly. don't make it too enjoyable, because then you're going to overeat. Like, this is one of the pillars of the satiety index, is that you need protein, you need fiber, there's something else, but you also need to remove a lot of the hedonistic nature of food. Mm. So you enjoy it a little bit, but you don't enjoy it so much that you want to eat more. I think you can make healthy food that with protein and fiber that tastes delicious, but it's still very difficult to overeat. Like, I think that's
I think they're missing the point too, because if we're looking at satiety, we would typically achieve very good satiety and autoregulation eating a diet that is based mostly on more unprocessed foods, right? That doesn't mean in that context we wouldn't want to add herbs, spices, you know, those types of things. Now, if we remove all of those, we're removing a massive element of nutrient density, because spices and herbs have some of the highest nutrient density of any foods, right? And I think potentially that's one of the issues with our ultra refined foods, is not just that they're highly palatable, they're highly calorie dense, you know, we're a lot of calories in a very small package. It's also that most of the flavors that are involved with them are not. They're not, you know, they're natural flavors with respect to coming from natural sources, but that doesn't mean anything in the food processing world. They're typically created from very isolated compounds. You know, a lot of them are created from corn, and they're basically just structural elements that give a taste sensation, but they don't have all of the cofactors that you would naturally get from, say, herbs and spices. And a lot of those are incredibly, dare I say it, medicinal. You know, we're talking about in small amounts here, but, you know, you look at the nutrient profile of herbs, it's pretty wicked. You know, they're like vegetables on steroids. Similarly, spices, you know, same sort of thing. So we lose all of that. We're potentially, I think, down the track going to be limiting how we can optimize our health, because those things are going to help just in a very small way, but a small amount of additive benefit over a long time and over a long term is going to be potentially pronounced.
You know, it's interesting, actually, because a lot of people say that things like that are overstated, Cliff, like, oh, a sprinkle of this here and some turmeric here, it's not really going to move the needle in terms of your like health outcomes or what you're trying to do. But to your point, like, if these are the things that we do every day and you have that accumulated sort of impact of things like herbs and spices, then got to make
it. What does, you know, does a set of push-ups in the morning do that much for your strength, endurance, or fitness? No. You do a set of push-ups every morning, yeah, there's going to be an effect. You know, does coffee have much of an effect on fat loss? I see it really being hammered at the moment. No, it's a small effect. But if that's additive on top of other things, that small effect consistently might actually be enough to sort of tip the balance. Even creatine has quite a small effect size, actually. But everyone still talks about it as the, you know, the king of supplements, and it is. But any one component, I think we're starting to see is actually quite limited in its effect. Even if initially we see quite pronounced results in studies, it tends to sort of even out a little bit. So, you know, no one thing is going to be the answer. And I think that's what we keep going back to, is people want that one thing. It's like, oh, you know, herbs and spices aren't that important. Well, okay, take them off. and then look at the accumulated amount of antioxidants and additional nutrients and things like that that you're getting over a lifetime, is that going to have an effect? I'd say it probably would.
Touch more on that caffeine. What are you seeing being hammered? Are people hammering it in terms of this is the thing for fat loss, or are they like everyone's overstating caffeine? Like what are you seeing?
I think it's more veering towards the absolutist where the effect is so small that it just doesn't matter. I would sort of agree in some respects, but I think if you can see, you know, we do see consistently that it does have an effect on fat utilization. It probably has an effect on fat loss over a period of time. That even if the effect is small, we shouldn't understate small effects, because most things independently or isolated have small effects.
Yeah, nice point. I reckon we could do a study on that, eh? You could do like, you know, how many milligrams of caffeine you would need per day on a group of individuals over like a 12-month period or something. That's good. I think caffeine's why I'm so ripped, to be honest. N equals one here. Hey, did you guys read that report that I sent through earlier this week saying we need to talk about this? Or did you at least read the executive summary? Or did you at least look at the nutrition and physical activity data?
I looked a little bit at it, yeah.
I like that. It took me like to break it. I didn't want to speak. Okay, so my major question is, are any of us at all surprised that nothing has changed over the last 15 years? Like, honestly, I read the data on the population numbers for how many people are with obesity, how many people, you know, are overweight, how many people are inactive, how many people meet their fresh fruit and vegetable yawn consumption, and nothing has changed. And I just wonder why anyone would have expected it to have changed, and what this sort of report adds to what we do or don't know about population health. Like, I don't know. Like, I just think, is this just a waste of, I don't know, a couple of $100,000 to put this together?
I don't think it's a waste. I think we always need updated information on where we're at, even if it is just to confirm that things haven't markedly shifted at all. And I think, though, as with a lot of research, the problem is in the translation to what we do next. You know, and we can make small changes to the dietary guidelines, and would that help? I don't think it would, really. You know, I think we're past that point, and I think we need to understand that the issues of societal health are more complex than isolating into nutrition, physical activity, or guidelines of any sort that people are supposed to just learn and follow, because we've got a system that is really, to some degree, antithetical to health. It's not doing that in an overt way, and it's no sort of conspiracy. It's just that that is not the primary driver of what we do in our modern world. You know, the modern world is geared towards productivity, efficiency, and perpetual growth. And that is not always congruent with having people on an individual or collective sort of level be healthier and happier. But see, I think we need to go, as you guys know, I think we need to think way beyond health. Because people, health is like massive, right? Health is a massive industry, full stop. Whether we're talking about public health or health in terms of influence, nutrition, training, you know, it's huge. And
oh, we're all in it.
We're in
totally.
It and everyone's into it. You know, as I've talked about in lots of conferences and workshops and things, this when we were all getting into nutrition years and years ago, we were pretty weird, right? To be that into nutrition. It was kind of still a little bit fringe. Now everyone's into nutrition. Everyone knows a bit about it, with rightly or wrongly. Everyone's taking photos of their fucking meals and doing all sorts of shit. And
you need a PhD for that. So everyone, like just like me.
But is that an objective outcome for people? And I just don't believe that it is. I think that it's, you know, a foundation that helps us to live a happier life. But unless we've evaluated what that life actually looks like, the pursuit of health as the end goal is very arbitrary, and I don't think it leads to any sort of overall change in our society, really. I think people need to be looking at what the real end goal is, like what's most important and how do I achieve that? And sure, health is a massive part of that, but we don't have that end goal in mind, and we certainly don't have it individually or collectively, I don't believe.
it's a big cultural shift in it. Talking to a few clients who've just sort of come back from Europe, and we talk about more than just health, but and obviously these countries that they're visiting are not perfect by any means either. But one thing that came across with some backwards and forwards was these ideas around is there in some countries more of a culture of wanting to be healthier and more productive and happier. And I'm thinking, you know, more into the Scandinavia kind of region, Switzerland. It's a very vague hypothesis, but certainly there seems to be more people who are actively pursuing that. And so then is it the culture? Is it how they're supported through government or society? And I'm a bit weird. Lately, I don't know if it's part of becoming a parent. I've got this thing, and I used to be into fast cars, and now I just think they are the stupidest thing ever, and we shouldn't have them, all right? And I know a lot of people would be very libertarian around, like, people should be able to do what they want, but sometimes you look at cars and you go, they are literally to get from A to B, so why are we allowed to have these 7-foot-tall spoilers and massive exhausts on cars? Like, just ban them. And if we took that attitude across to food, it gets a little bit dicier. Because I think most people in essence would be like, yeah, those cars are a bit stupid. And most people, 99.9% of people who drive those cars are not interested in obeying the rules for the most part. So then should we ban da-da-da-da when it comes to food and remove obstacles, which is part of what we're talking about way back to morning routines, getting it done early, making it easier. Would it be easier if fruit and veggies were cheap and you couldn't buy chocolate? And again, I love chocolate, so I don't want that. But where does it lie on the spectrum? How much should the government stick their nose in the name of public health? I lean towards a little bit more, but then of course it's who watches the watchman, right? We think it could be, we go down a very dark path if the wrong people. And that's, I guess, our opinion too. If I decided that that's the wrong approach, too late now. I've voted for that government to lay out nutritional policy.
Mm.
Yeah. So I know solutions there, just gave more problems.
I think there's potentially some leads that we would see in the research, though, right? Because I think what we do know fairly well, based on a lot of study in behavioral psychology and behavioral economics in particular, mostly from behavioral economics, is that punitive actions are a poor driver of motivation.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So if I'm going to punish you for something, it's not that good a driver of motivation. If I'm going to reward you directly for something, that's not a good driver of motivation either. So, the sort of carrot or stick are probably both quite limited. The biggest drivers of motivation are pretty much culture and social pressure. So I think to your point, Daz, I wonder if in those types of places there is a much better culture of, maybe it's just community. We know that that's one of those things that's really strongly associated with longevity, right? Is having strong and stable community, lots of social support. That's a really important part of eating in a lot of these places, is you're eating with, friends and family. It's very much for social enjoyment, all those types of things. So I think with social cohesion and community and a really good culture, I think maybe a lot of these things just start to occur. Maybe it also gives the space for people to be able to have, I guess, the wherewithal to start to think a little bit more about what makes them happy. I don't know, but I think those are important. They're important questions to consider.
Yeah, I think space is a big one. New Zealand trying to cut their carbon, for example, but we know, we're a very tiny country, so there's that sort of argument versus, if Russia and America don't do it, then is there any point in us trying so hard? And then who are penalized, perhaps lower socioeconomic first, if we talk about, recycling, if people can't afford fruit and veggies, do they really care about recycling? So there's those issues I think about a lot, is like how do we get those bigger things addressed when often there's other way more important issues to some people that's all they're going to be thinking about.
Big time. Yeah, I mean the brain space and the energy to think about all these things is, I don't think, available to a lot of people. And that includes us at times, right? Even though we probably benefit from being in this industry and having habits that have developed over a long time, that allows us to be a bit more resilient in the face of all these stresses in life. But if we didn't know so much about nutrition and training and we hadn't devoted our lives to it and we were in some other job, getting home after a 10, 11, 12 hour day, you know, what are we going to default to? We don't have a lot of the knowledge that would allow us to make good choices. We're being bombarded with information, which is really disparate and confusing. And so I can completely understand why people just say, look, I just don't know what to do. I just default to grabbing whatever's in the pantry, or I'll just go down the local takeaway and buy whatever I feel like, because I just want at that point to eat and I want to be satisfied and I want some degree of enjoyment, you know, like we're talking about treats before. And that's the other thing with social, you know, what people call social vices, alcohol, drugs, tobacco. You know, we often penalize very harshly people who use those things. But I also have a bit of empathy for them, because if that's all you got, like if that's your thing, that at the end of the week you've got $20 that you can spend on a pack of ciggies. I don't know whether you can buy a pack of ciggies for $20.
I don't think you can.
Or maybe get a dozen beers or something. You know, if that's your one treat, your one sort of vice that you have, who are we to say you're wrong per se? And who are we to say that you're morally wrong for that? Because it is, we're all complicit in that, right? We're all culpable to some degree in having a society that doesn't reward people that well. You know, considering that our minimum wage is way below what the living wage is. That's crazy to me, to think that you have people who are being paid less than what they need to live healthily and happily.
Crazy.
Like I just don't get that.
Yeah.
And so those people are we, and you know, the idea, I was reading a really interesting article on the idea of unskilled labor, and a lot of unskilled labor, probably most of it, the vast majority is actually quite highly skilled, because not any of us could just walk into someone's unskilled labor job and do it very well.
Oh, 100%.
They have particular skills. It's just that it's stuff that's not always palatable to most people. It's often hard work. It's paid really poorly. And a lot of what is considered unskilled is based on societal tropes, you know? And I just don't get how someone who cleans toilets should get paid almost nothing, because that's a literally shitty job, right?
Yeah.
I think they should be paid quite well for it, because who wants to do it? Yeah. If you're being paid for something that no one else wants to do,
surely
you're actually a fairly rare person, so you should probably be rewarded quite well for it. Yeah. Sorry, I went on a bit of a tangent there, but
no, that's such a good point. I was thinking about that in my Form 7 year. I had a cleaning job 8 till 11 at night from Monday through Friday. I can't even believe I did that now, actually. But my dad is a cleaner, and I was so rubbish. Like, seriously, I don't know how I managed to keep that job for the entire year. Like, because I couldn't clean, and it wasn't through lack of effort, but for whatever reason, I'd keep getting these. You'd have the performance sort of reviews every sort of 3 months. I do believe I held that job for only like 12 months, and I would just like barely pass the mustard every time. And it wasn't because I was just lazy or didn't try. Like, I legit just couldn't do it properly. Like, it just wasn't actually in my skill set to see detail to be able to do what they wanted me to do. I mean, I could do it an all right job, but that was about it. You said something. You go.
Oh, no, on Sunday, Mick, I don't know if you guys saw this, but I put up a spring pre-trampoline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did.
And so you've probably got one,
yeah.
Des. I'd love to hear your opinion on it. But they say you need two people, you know, at least two people to put it up, whatever. And it was just me. So I put up this thing. It was hard, man. It was really hard. And I know that as I was getting towards the end, I realized there was a lot of technique involved and it became a bit easier. But putting in some of those little tension struts nearly broke me. Like, I'm not a weak person, but it was really freaking hard. And I messaged one of my mates who has one and said, oh, dude, that was one of the physically hardest things I've done, was to put this thing up by myself. And he just messaged back and said, "Oh, dude, I just got it installed," and the guy came around and did it in 20 minutes. he said this little guy came around and just snapped it together in like 20 minutes. Amazing. So that goes to show that that dude is probably putting up, I don't know, 5 of these things a day.
Yeah.
And like I say, I'm not a weak person, and I found it one of the hardest things I've done. But that guy's not unskilled. He's got a lot of skill putting up those trampolines, you know?
100%.
Have you got one, Dan?
Yeah, we went old school. We got the spring one. But yeah, there's a special tool that you had to like hook onto the springs and drag to get them in, times 100 of them or more. And yeah, massive grip, massive. And I tried to turn it into a game, you know, figuring out the best leverage and swapping hands and this, that, and the other. I was doing it for Christmas Day. So I did half the job Christmas Eve, and then I got up at 5 a.m. and finished it off so it could be up for the morning. did it solo as well. I rush into any kind of task like that and then find that it's 5% from finished and I've done something wrong right at the beginning that involves me having to completely dismantle it and start again, you know, like furniture and things. So I've learned to slow down.
Yeah.
So this is partly necessity and partly planned to split it over 2 days just to ensure I could actually get through a very technical process.
Unsurprisingly, I would just outsource all of that. Cliff, I know what I was going to say, actually, on the back of you talking about everyone's sort of social vice. Alcohol. And this has, if I say alcohol has gotten a bad rap on social media lately, it's not that it's ever been sort of celebrated as something we should all, you know, include and enjoy, albeit I do include and I do enjoy. And that would be my social vice of choice. But after that bloody Huberman podcast, right, and he's really banging the drum in every single podcast that he can possibly insert into it, I don't drink. He does it regardless of how relevant it is to the conversation, and he manages to sort of like say that in every single conversation he has of the podcast I've listened to. The interesting thing is how everyone has, apart from you, Cliff, and Chris Masterjohn, has sort of jumped on this, no amount of alcohol is safe, no one should drink, sort of message. And look, I'm not going to say it's healthy because it's not, but both you and Chris Masterjohn pointed out that the sort of the role that toxins might play in our health, and they're not all necessarily bad news, Cliff. So I was interested to chat to you a little bit about that. But first, I want to know, like, do you guys drink? Like, I mean, what's your sort of usual sort of like approach to alcohol?
It depends. Like, I bought, I think, a dozen beers on maybe the day before New Year's Eve or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I only just replaced them. So I had like 12 beers over the course of 2 months. So I've bought another dozen beers and I've had one a day since then. So, you know, it goes up and down, but I don't drink a lot. I never drink much at all. It might be one or two beers in a sitting, and usually it's only, you know, 1 or 2 days a week. So I probably average 2 drinks a week. So it's bugger all.
Yeah.
Do you drink at all, Des?
I'm pretty similar. It's gone up. It's gone up since having a daughter. And that's where I'm like somewhat conflicted. If we go circle right back to the story I was telling about refusing to touch bread, there was at that time of my life, I didn't touch alcohol at all either. And it was very much, you know, I was in fitness for performance and competition and winning and da da da. And that was a whole different kettle of fish. These days, yeah, but much more moderate approach. Love a social glass of wine or a cider on a hot summer's day. But I've definitely noticed that 1 or 2 will affect sleep. And I've also noticed over the last couple of years that my wife and I, it was like, what a day we've just had. I need a wine. I need a cider. And we both kind of didn't like that. We felt like alcohol was going to fix it, you know, and that maybe is tying back into the treat cheat meal as well. Like, it just, there's nothing wrong with that per se. It is nice to have something good after a slog. But were we taking kind of the wrong approach about, oh, I need this glass because it's been the day and I need it to help me get to sleep or whatever. So yeah, we haven't quit. We've just tried to be a little bit more mindful of, I guess, not our quantity, but just our approach or our why behind why we're having now. And I definitely would prefer it to take it as a social reason than a medicative one, I suppose. I think Cliff and I have talked about it yonks ago. This study I always stuck in my mind. I saw it in when I was doing my postgrad, and the graph was kind of a tick shape, and it was like talking about units of alcohol per day and mortality, and it showed that zero was slightly worse than one, but then after one it got worse again. And that seemed to suggest, though, that moderation was just the best approach, and people who were being moderate in their drinking were probably also moderate in any other vices or approaches. And one drink is probably consumed in more of a social situation than by yourself, where you might, you know, be five or six. And that teetotalism, or maybe it's too extreme about other things, or did not have a social network that promoted an occasional friendly drink. And that was an issue, right, when we see the power of social settings with longevity as well. So that's where we're currently at.
I've seen that whole, you know, no safe dose trope trotted out so much recently, and it was funny because I did a little thread on the JAMA meta-analysis from last year, I think it was, you know, sort of the latest meta-analysis on alcohol and all-cause mortality, and I had a whole bunch of people replying with the study I was talking about, saying, hey, well, what about this? So, well, that's the exact study I was talking about. And it shows that if you're having less than, I think it was actually that the amount wasn't that low. It surprised me. You know, if you're having sort of less than, I think it was around 3 drinks per day. And the standard drinks is a tough one as well, because it differs by country. So I think it's, you know, it could be 2 or it could be up to 4, depending on the country and how they standardize their drinks. But it's not that small an amount, right? And I probably think that's maybe a little bit too high. And other studies have shown that maybe it's closer for all-cause mortality, or particularly cancer-related mortality, is maybe around 1 drink per day. But it's certainly not, you know, no safe dose. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find anything that has no safe dose. Like even things that we know as toxins like arsenic, it might actually be a micro essential trace nutrient, but we're never going to not get the amount we need from just normal exposure, right? So any amount over that is probably going to be harmful to health. But still, if we get right into the minutiae, there's going to be some dose at which it's safe. And I think people always need to consider that when they're talking about toxins and whether something is toxic. You know, I had someone say the other day, well, but sugar's toxic. I said, okay, well, let's look at it acutely. Try and kill yourself with sugar. You're going to be very hard pressed to do it acutely, right? Eat as much sugar as you can tomorrow and see if you die. It's probably not going to happen. Now take water and drink as much water as you can tomorrow. You'll probably kill yourself, right? So even things that obviously there's toxicity with anything that's essential, you know, some things are actually remarkably safe. You know, try and kill yourself with alcohol, very easy. Try and kill yourself with cannabis, almost impossible. You know, there's a lot of nuance within that. And I just think people love to get the simplest answer from the simplest podcast out there.
I still remember visiting the cadaver lab in Auckland Med School, and the doctor pulled out the woman's lungs, which were black as, and said, what do you think's going on here? And we were like, oh, smoking. No. She was 80 and she lived in Auckland all her life. Smog.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then we were like, oh, moving to the country.
Air quality. Yeah. Air quality is a massive morbidity and mortality risk. Yeah. Huge.
You made your escape from Auckland, Darren.
Yeah. And ended up in the mountain where it seems like traffic is proportionally worse. Because everyone's either trying to go from the Mount to Tauranga or from Papamoa to Tauranga and back again along this little isthmus, and so which is similar to the way Auckland's set up. So yeah, just on a different level. So yeah, I don't know, but I am lucky. I can walk and bike where I need to go, and my wife has a little Vespa, and she scoots along to work. So it's definitely an improvement for us personally. But by gosh, some people suffer majorly for traffic around here, which is interesting.
We never drive. I drive twice a week.
What a luxury, though, isn't it? Isn't it just amazing? We become a one car family, and I think we fill it's a diesel, admittedly, but we still fill it up every 5 or 6 weeks. And the Vespa is already.
We've thought about it, but I can't get rid of my little Jimny.
Have you got a Jimny?
Because it'll go forever. Yeah, you know, it's. I bought it new. It's paid off. It's gonna go forever. So I just gotta keep that.
Yeah, I got sick of having to go to get petrol, so we got an e-vehicle, which is.
Did you?
Yeah, did. And it's taken a little bit to get used to.
Let me guess, you bought a Tesla because Huberman drives one, right?
Oh, does he? And he's probably got a Model 3. We don't. But yeah, like, and it has actually been a little bit life-changing to not have to go to the petrol station to constantly fill up on petrol and then get aggrieved at the cost of petrol that tends to be rising, but seems to be rising every time you would go to the petrol station, you know, like.
I don't even look at the pump, or at least, and when I used to have my 6-liter Jeep, I did not look at the pump at all.
I think I spend $80 a month.
Yeah.
On gas.
That's nothing, really.
So it's
really.
Not much.
No, totally not at all.
If that, I don't even know if I spend that, to be honest.
So here's an interesting thing then, sort of circling back to some of the stuff I was saying. If public transport was just incredibly prolific, reliable, safe, affordable, what might that do to public health, nutrition, steps?
Yes.
It would be certainly interesting. Just sort of multiple things, not solved, but improved with by only focusing on one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think that is a really interesting example, because I believe at least that it's a victim of looking at things in a very isolated fashion and having to have isolated profit centers. So, you know, you privatize public transport in Auckland and huge number of bus routes are cut because they're not efficient, they're not profitable. But then my question is, how does that then affect the overall economy? You know, it's not like in your business, every single element of it is a profit driver. Mm. It's not, because some of it's admin and some of it's other things that just need to be done. It's exactly the same in an economy, but people don't look at it that way. It's like, well, the buses need to be profitable. The trains need to be profitable. Well, they don't necessarily. If it's driving better efficiencies across the board, that's a good thing. More importantly, if it's driving improved health and improved happiness, shouldn't that be a metric we also look at as part of our overall sort of national statistics? And I think going forward, we're going to have to change the way we look at how we measure and quantify these things, because I'm really concerned that we're, a lot of us are going to be out of a job. Now, I know a lot of people are doomsayers in this respect. We all could be completely wrong, but I just can't see how a lot of people in the current environment are going to keep their jobs when AI can do it better.
Yeah, interesting.
Some things are better done by people, but there are a lot of things that are better done by AI. And so there's going to be a massive problem with underemployment. How do we address that? Do we just allow for people to subsist, you know, make very little money and just eke along, not being food secure, you know, because bots have taken over the jobs? I just don't think we can allow that to happen, right? But to rectify it takes a massive revision of how we see every component within the society and the economy.
Which economies operate the way that you're describing, Cliff?
In terms of
that, not looking sort of individually at each component, but looking sort of across the board, like which economies, because I'm really ignorant about this, so I figure you're going to know that there's going to be, what is it, how the Scandinavian countries do it is, yeah, what's the go?
Yeah, typically, I mean, it tends to be those that are more socialist in respect to democratic socialism, you know, and not the democratic socialist republic of whatever, because obviously we know that's just a cover for communism. But yeah, the Scandinavian countries, and I think any country that is more egalitarian, and that can be achieved in two ways. Obviously, you've got, you know, taxation, as you see in the Scandinavian countries, or as you see in countries like Japan, which is more egalitarian, surprisingly, than a lot of other developed nations. It's through social pressure. So there is a social pressure to not have executives paid 300 times what your normal workers paid, as you see in the States. So where you see that, I think there's a lot more money that is put into the elements of social cohesion, and transport's obviously a massive part of that. You know, in Auckland alone, I think getting on top of the public transport challenges would just have an enormous impact. But it's difficult to do because of a whole range of things, you know, particularly election cycles.
Yeah.
People don't want to spend a lot of money acutely because that's unpalatable for people, and you're probably going to find yourself voted out. I don't have any answers. I just basically proselytize and say things with no solution. So I'm probably part of the problem.
Wouldn't it be amazing if some sort of billionaire
philanthropist.
There you go. Philanthropist. Went, right, here's $30 billion, Auckland Transport. This is what you can do with it. And actually, like, the money just appeared from nowhere. And then suddenly things were fixed. Like, because I can't see any huge changes in funding that will allow something like what you were sort of
It's funny, Mickey, because I literally just said that to someone last week, that I knew it was a sign that I must be getting old, because that whole what would you buy if you were a billionaire? That's literally my fantasy, is if I was a billionaire, I would sort out public transport. I'm not lying. I'm obviously getting a little bit too long in the tooth, because that's what would give me the most pleasure.
Yeah. It also harks to your point, Des, about cars.
United States? This stat blew my mind. On a per capita basis, cars per head of population, America, New Zealand, first frickin' equal.
Wow. And as far as I know, and someone listening in can probably prove me wrong here, but from what I have seen in the past, I think we also are the worst, along with Australia, for throwing away electronic goods.
Oh.
So throwing away computers, phones, things like that. Wow. Both of which I think is interesting, because I think they both speak to the idea of satisficing as a solution to that. You guys know the idea of satisficing? It's an economic term.
Yeah. Define that for us.
So it's basically the concept that we're good enough is good enough. You don't need to go beyond that. So if your needs are being met, going beyond that is typically an ever increasing sort of cascade, right? Mm-hmm. In which, you know, you get a new car and you want the next better car. But if your car is serving all of your needs, and we're not just talking about this sort of very functional necessities, but if it's filling you up, if it's enough, you know, to be congruent really with your ethos and values, at some point you need to understand that the pursuit of the next better thing is trying to fill a void that you'll never fill.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So the idea of satisficing, I think, is a really interesting one, because I believe at least that if people satisficed more or brought that into their being and the way that they did things, we would have far lesser need for stuff. And that is potentially one of our biggest solutions to the problems we have.
Yeah.
You know, we throw away so much food. We throw away so many electronic goods. We buy so many things that sit unused. You know, when I was sponsored by a shoe company, I think I had something like 50 pairs of shoes.
Wow.
It was wicked, because I had all these cool shoes, but how often was I going to wear them? And when I moved back to New Zealand, I gave them all away to homeless people, right? And that's not a virtuous thing. It's not because I'm like, oh, I'm giving away to homeless. It was more so that I thought, I can't take all these things back. I probably don't need them, so I'll just give them away, right? And I haven't replaced them. And as you guys know, I seldom wear shoes anyway.
Yeah.
I probably still have too many pairs of shoes, because they've been accumulated because people have given them to me or whatever.
Yeah.
But I probably in any month would wear two pairs of shoes.
Do you know, I understand that, because like I love shoes, and I feel sad to walk on by like Platypus and see all these amazing shoes and go, it's just no point, because right now I'm only wearing running shoes, sometimes jandals, and then my Nike Freeze, like that legitimately are all, and maybe I bust out my sneaks for a night out. I mean, you know, white sneakers, not sneaks.
I think though, one element within that though is important, is that if you really love shoes, like you're a sneakerhead, I don't think there's a problem with that necessarily, because I don't think most people are sneakerheads. Just like in the same way that if you do love a particular mark of car, like you love Mercedes or you love Porsche or whatever, and it's intrinsically driven, get yourself a Porsche. But if you're buying that Porsche because you're trying to fill a void and you don't know what that void is, or you think that people are going to think you're cooler, smarter, more handsome, more attractive, whatever, maybe reevaluate things a little bit and figure out whether you really need that. Because to my mind, you know, if you're happy with a Toyota Corolla and you buy a Porsche, even if nothing else, you could have bought the Toyota Corolla and given all that extra money to charity. Like, that's probably going to be a better outcome at the end of the day. But it comes down to knowing what your ethos and values are. And there's no right or wrong, right? I'm not saying that you shouldn't buy a Porsche. I'm saying if you love it and it's intrinsically driven, buy the Porsche. If it's not,
buy the Corolla.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember the guy who started Wired. Do you remember Cliff? He wrote a book around like sort of futurism, future predictions, and it was like the drones would bring you clothes and you'd have your measurements on file. And he sort of was like an extended Amazon is where we were going to go. So it's like, I need to go to a wedding. Don't have a suit, but it's cool. Did an order one. Drone would drop it off, tailored to you, go to the wedding, put it back in your little receptacle in the backyard. Drone comes, picks it up, takes it back to the warehouse and resizes it for the next person. And the same would go for the lawnmower that you rent every 10 days, because you don't really need to own a lawnmower because it sits idle for 9 of those 10. And so on and so on and so on. And we're seeing some of that with some of these car sharing things. And I know someone tried to start a tool sharing platform in New Zealand. I think it was called Mutu or something like that. But I don't think it fired. It makes so much sense, but I'm sure there's that obstacle to getting that critical mass. But certainly sharing stuff, you know, the way we used to, we talked a lot about the past. That could be one interesting approach. To kind of having your cake and eating it too.
Yeah, for sure.
Definitely.
Yeah. And yeah, and then the people who are like, as you said, the true enthusiasts are going to be like, well, no, I want that Porsche for me and I keep it. But there's going to be less of them overall, which theoretically shouldn't make it such of an issue versus all of us wanting to keep everything, which is the electronic thing, I suppose. That shows that we're all on in the electronic buzz. We've all got the phone, the computer that we're chucking out too soon.
Yeah. Because I think so much of that is perception-based, and we all know this, but, you know, it's very easy to assume that, for example, a lot of the Chinese retailers are unethical, and it's probably true. But we don't always consider that, hey, a lot of the retail outlets we buy from here, they're getting this stuff from the same places. It's the same thing. Like, you'll know, Daz, remember the old story of when, I won't say who it was, but we both know very well fitness equipment suppliers who have been accidentally sent product from the factories in China that was stamped for another company that is supposedly like the gold standard. Yeah. It's, you know, the US based or Europe based one or whatever. It's all made in the same place. You know, you look at phones, try and buy an ethical phone and look at the ethical or, you know, ratings of ethics for these phone companies. You're not going to find one. There is one company that makes ethical phones, but they're just not as high spec. Mm. So, you know, are you going to sacrifice your upload time or your download time or your ability to watch this or that for a more ethical phone? Most people aren't going to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I bought a new portafilter from a coffee machine from a New Zealand company and then saw it on Temu. And to the packaging was quite distinct. So I know it was that exact one, and it was on Temu for, you know, a tenth of the price. So they're obviously just bringing them in by the truckload from Temu and then selling them on. And, you know, you've got to get them from somewhere, and there's everyone's, you know, distributorship's been that way for a long time. But it's being open and honest and upfront about where it's all coming from and the markup, perhaps.
Yeah.
Hey, so guys, I'm mindful of your time. I do just want to ask a couple more questions. Because I'm sort of interested.
I don't even know what we've been talking about today. I had 4 hours sleep last night. we've just been going off.
Do you know, right? But this is sort of why I wanted to have, I wasn't joking. Like when I started this by saying it's just a good opportunity to have a catch up. And literally it is. Like I'll just throw a couple of things in I've been thinking about. And I know that you guys can riff on whatever what comes to mind for me, because we're often interested in the same things. But you're just far smarter than I am about it. So I learn a lot. Personally, though,
probably just more vocal, Mick, not smarter.
Oh yeah, that's what I meant. Sorry, I didn't mean smarter.
I'm more prepared to move outside of my lane.
Yeah, love a rant,
yeah, which I quite like. So supplements wise, I have to confess I'm so terrible at supplements. I was so good for so long. And Cliff, you counseled me on some really great things to get last year. And we chatted on a podcast about me taking NAC the way that you do. I basically just copy you. And the Resveratrol, I think, from Thorne. I was taking a whole bunch of things, but literally right now I managed to remember to take my biotin, because I take biotin, and magnesium, and that's about as far as I get. I forget every other supplement. So where are you guys at with supplements? Cliff, let's start with you. and then Daz will come back on and he can tell me about his supplements. Where are you at with your supplements there, Cliff? I know fish oils, obviously.
Yeah, probably a little bit like you. I've cut back a bit just because I kind of wanted to reset and just get back to basics. You know, try and do a little bit more through food and, I started accumulating things. So I also get given quite a lot of products. You know, I'll be at a conference and I'll, you know, give a talk or whatever, and then everyone's giving me product to try. And so you try it out, and then eventually you've got 15 things in your cupboard and you're just not using anything. So I'm just sticking to, I pretty much just supplement in the morning. I just have it all in my morning shake. It's just protein, greens, fish oil. And then after training, protein and creatine. So that's it. That's all I'm doing.
Yeah. Yeah. All righty. And Darren, you're back with us. What about you? What I don't think I've asked you about your supplement routine.
Yeah, very similar to Cliff. And I've been through the whole gamut of trying everything and having a supplement cupboard a mile deep. Back to simplicity. Good greens, vitality, creatine. I've been reworking collagen into the mix. Curious if there's any latest data on that stuff. But Cliff, jits, man, elbow tendonitis. I got turf toe. My fingers hurt. I think I jumped in a little bit too enthusiastically, so mostly myself to blame. But staying on top of that has been a big focus. Collagen is back in the mix.
You'll be too strong for your own good, I think.
I try really hard not to overdo it.
No, straight up. I use collagen too.
That's good to know. But yeah, so then I think we're the same. Fish oil, greens, creatine, collagen, and protein. That's the five.
Yeah. All right. So I did actually forget to add that I obviously have protein and always have good greens, vitality, and actually have creatine as well. For some reason, I didn't think about them in terms of my supplements, though. I just sort of, I don't know why. I think they're just so ingrained into the idea that they're just part of my diet. Interesting on that collagen thing, Darren, like you might find this not from a research perspective, but anecdotally, and Stu Phillips said this actually as well, that so many people say that having the collagen really helps their joints. So there's not much in the research about that, but that's something anecdotally. And interestingly, according to Stu, there was not that much about joint. So I'm trying to think. I haven't seen much on joints actually, though, Cliff.
I'll have to go back and look, but I think there is research. I think it's not in general populations. There is certainly information on inflammation and pain in people with osteoarthritis.
Okay, cool. That'll be good to know. Unless, of course, I've known that and forgotten it, which is possible. But no, I'm sure that I would have remembered. I saw there was a study last year where collagen helped with muscle protein synthesis. Like a study looked at collagen and that it helped increase muscle protein synthesis. Now, I don't know how that. I mean, obviously, leucine is like the trigger for MPS, but it's not the main. It's not the story. It's not everything. So, I was interested to see that. And Cliff, you nodded like you. That's not news to you either, which is great.
I don't think that's an old finding because I believe, again, I'll have to dig back into the research, but I have looked at this previously, and I think that collagen has had an effect on muscle growth parameters before, right? But it's not as good as other proteins. But to some degree, a protein is going to be a protein, right?
Do you need more of it?
Well, it just wouldn't do the job because it's not as high in some of those essential amino acids. So, you know, we wouldn't take it for that purpose. But if people are taking a bit of collagen or having some bone broth or whatever, it's not like it's not going to help across their total protein balance for the day. And I think that's where people misunderstand it. It's like, well, it's not as good a protein for muscle growth, therefore it's useless. So, well, no, it's just not as good.
Yeah.
You know, in the same way that people say, well, you know, plant-based proteins aren't as good. Well, maybe marginally, but the reality is if you're getting enough protein across the day,
you're right,
and you're well within that range, then it's probably not going to make much difference whatsoever.
Yeah.
And again, it just comes down to being pragmatic, right? This absolutism, you know, coffee's toxic. No, it's not. The dose is in the poison. You know, alcohol's toxic. Well, yes, it is, but the dose is in the poison. You know, plant protein sucks. Well, no, it doesn't. It just might not be quite as good for those parameters of muscle growth as an animal-based protein. But at the end of the day, I mean, geez, just people need to stop polarizing things so much.
I couldn't resist the other day doing an invisible smoothie reel where it was like me talking to myself as two different people, and it was, you know, like holding up ingredients, and then my friend was the snooty person reading too much research and was like, oh, bananas are bad, berries are bad, oh, spinach has, you know, oxalic acid, and eventually it was a glass of nothing because you just can't win.
Exactly.
Do you know what, though? I think people love majoring in the minors, don't they? Because then, and this is, I'm going to be blunt, but majoring in the minors gives people that break on doing nothing at all. They're like, you know, it's like, oh, no, I'm so overwhelmed because I'm told these, you know, 10 different things. And then they don't actually bother reading any material from anything that you might provide them. They're constantly offering up objections as to why something's not going to work for them. They've switched their brain off, and then it just gives them another excuse for something else not to work or for them not to make change. That's a bit blunt, but that's how I see it.
And there is so much hypocrisy when we start to fall into those traps, particularly from an influencer point of view. You know, I'll give you a couple of examples. I've seen an influencer, pretty well known, pretty well qualified, very hot on the topic of, you know, sugar's not that big a deal. Within the context of a healthy diet, if you're having some added sugar, having some foods, processed foods with sugar, and it's not a big deal, I agree entirely. But then that same person is saying, oh, but saturated fat is associated with higher LDL, it is associated with heart disease, you know.
I'm saying,
oh, hold on, well, that's not congruent, because if you're saying that about sugar, which I agree with, you have to say the same about saturated fat. Within the context of a healthy diet and lifestyle, it's probably not an issue. What was the other example? I forget now, but that was a good enough example anyway.
That's good.
Influencers hammering Huberman. I understand why they do it,
yeah.
Right? But influencers hammering Huberman for promoting a particular multi and, you know, saying it's just spruiking a supplement, blah, blah, blah. But then also in other posts saying, well, if I had to recommend one supplement, it would probably be a multi. It's like, well, where's the congruence there?
Yeah.
What I think they're actually saying is that the supplement that he promotes is more expensive. But if that means the supplement that you're potentially promoting or what you're suggesting to people is they go and get a cheap multi, I certainly wouldn't agree with that. Because I think that very few people understand the difference in forms of the ingredients,
yeah,
forms of the various vitamins and minerals, whether they're absorbable, whether they're usable, et cetera. And so it just doesn't seem like it's entirely congruent, right? To sort of have one message and then promote it with a hypocritical message or something that's very similar, but yeah, tirade over.
That's great. Something else, the last question, actually, the last question, because you guys have families to get back to, et cetera. What are we eating right now? What's our favorite food? What's our favorite food? Not what are we eating, because I sort of know what you're going there, but any faves on the menu right now that you're just hammering?
Burger bowls.
Oh, I love a burger bowl.
Yeah, I'm digging burger bowl. So come back to what Cliff said earlier about that summery crunch of veggies. I can't do salad in the winter. I try, it just never really takes, but now that we're in the middle of summer, and got a nice big shiny barbecue, so that's in use on a regular basis. And yeah, putting together these massive burger patties. And then, yeah, it's Max doesn't you say big ass, was it big ass salad?
Yeah.
Just anything I can find in that thing. And it's just, I use an actual, I don't know if it's like a 5 liter mixing bowl. That's my salad bowl.
Oh, your dinner
so
bowl?
I can get more in. And I use scissors to chop the, the leaves up with the scissors so that it sits down a little lower and I can fit more in.
Nice one. I do that too. I cut my leaves up. Need to.
I'm not the only one.
No. What about you, Cliff? What's your...
This isn't something that's now. This is probably consistent through my life. If I ever need to default to something, it's sausages.
Oh.
I bloody love a sausage. I love sausages. I love sausages and bread. I love sausages with salad. I love sausages with mash of all sorts of types. I love sausages with sauerkraut. And I just love a good sausage.
I love a bloody sausage.
sounds like a Dr. Seuss book.
Yeah. Dr. Seussage.
Amazing.
New Zealand has crap sausages. I'm going to say it out loud. Overall, like on average. Compared to America, I reckon, which you can get the worst food in the world, right, Mickey? But, oh, my gosh, you've really got to read the label or you end up with this sort of 60-something percent meat sausage so easily. And they're sitting there premium, da-da-da, all the labeling. It's so hard to find something that's kind of on that 80-plus range.
Yeah.
That's a big rant for me because I'm similar to you, Cliff. Love a saucy. And I just want some people to put some blooming good ingredients in there.
That's a fair call.
What's your go-to brand?
I don't even remember. We sort of shop around online for good deals. So I couldn't even give you a brand off the top of my head, but we do look at that. We try and look at, you know, sausages that are predominantly, you know, almost entirely meat wherever possible.
I'm going to say Frank's is one variety and Le Authentique. I don't think I've said that correctly, but that's another brand which is basically just meat. Love it. Although I am partial to a spicy chorizo Woolworth sausage, actually. Quite delicious.
Slumming it, Mickey.
Oh, and hey, do you know what? In fact, like one of the reasons why I know that I like them is because I often see them with the yellow sticker on them and I'm like, oh, cheap, I'm going to get them. So with anything, when I go to the supermarket and that meat aisle, if it's got that yellow sticker, I am looking hard and going, how much am I saving here? Oh, yeah. That's because protein, because healthy food's not cheap, people. So do what you can to save.
Yeah. Harmony, I think we do the Harmony ones as a default.
Yeah.
But yeah. Still looking for that market leader.
Hey, guys, always appreciate your time. Thank you so much for making yourselves available to join me for this morning. And I know that people will know where they can find you, but I'm just going to get you guys to reel off that information again. Darren, where can people find you?
DarrenAllis.coach everywhere, website, Instagram.
Amazing. And Cliff?
Nice. Best place is the Holistic Performance Institute, which is just holisticperformance.institute.
Nice one. And you're not going to be public about your, what about Cliffy Dog? That's been a little bit more active of late.
Oh, people can follow me on Instagram at CliffDoggyDog, but pretty much everything I do. It's because I'm not really doing much outside of the teaching now. So it's all about the students and the institute. So
nice.
That's what I'm doing.
Now, Katie and I caught up actually earlier this week and she was like, how's Cliff going? She's like, God, if only we had his course when we were learning nutrition. She's like, every time I get contacted by an up-and-coming nutritionist, I send them Cliff's way because that is a great course. So,
wicked.
Yeah, it's very well revered across the professionals, you know, lots of other people like us, Cliff. So I love that. It's awesome.
Kudos. Thanks, Katie.
All right, team. Well, hey, we will wrap this up and I'll let you know when this comes out, Ovs, and we'll do this again sometime.
It's going to need some heavy editing, I reckon, this one.
Oh, maybe.
Gary's going to have his work cut out.
He'll be like...
Rough and ready. Great to see you, gang.
Actually, what will happen is Barry will be like, oh, that Cliff, I actually had to edit everything out, so it's only a half-hour conversation between you and Daz.
I wouldn't be worried. I wouldn't be concerned about that at all. That would be completely okay today.
All right, team. Catch ya.
See you guys. Bye.
See ya.
Alrighty, team. Hopefully you enjoyed that conversation. We could talk for hours, actually, because you can just go down so many tangents, go into different rabbit holes, etc. But we managed to keep it not too long for you this time. So, as I said, you can find links to both Darren and Cliff in the show notes. And next week on the podcast, I have the pleasure of talking to Marco Altini about heart rate variability. Really great conversation, so make sure you tune into that next Wednesday. Until then, though, you can catch me over on Instagram, Twitter, and Threads at Mickey Willardin, Facebook at Mickey Willardin Nutrition, or head to my website, mickeywillardin.com, and book a one-on-one call with me. All right, team, have the best week. See you later.